Committee, while the Tax Committee cancels the more rural-looking bonding committee, except for maybe Senator Wieger, is here and ready for duty. and so today we're going to hear from Department of Human Services, Department of Public Safety, and Department of Corrections relative to their bonding requests going forward. And to do that, and I understand the overhead is not quite ready, but we'll work off our paper copies. And to start from the Department of Human Services, Mr. Chuck Johnson, Chief Financial Officer. Welcome, Mr. Johnson. You begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck Johnson, Chief Financial Officer with the Department of Human Services. You have a packet, a PowerPoint in your packet that should look something like this. That should be the cover slide that you're seeing that I will be walking through, and hopefully maybe at some point we can get it up on the screen. The Department of Human Services, first of all, thank you for the opportunity to be here today to share the governor's recommendations for the Department of Human Services bonding request. We are requesting $47.3 million in this bonding round. I will talk quite a bit about the St. Peter campus, where we have both the Minnesota Sex Offender Program and the Minnesota Security Hospital. That's where much of the focus of our request is. A number of you had an opportunity to visit down to St. Peter, I believe it was in January, and take a tour of that facility as well to sort of help understand our request. Starting with the first page that presents the dollar figures in the request for the Department of Human Services, it's actually slide two. You'll see that we have four requests that we're making. The first is for the Minnesota Security Hospital for $40 million for design and construction to remodel facilities. Secondly, also in St. Peter, the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, $1.7 million. This is pre-design and design money. For both of those requests, you can see that these are phased projects. There's a second phase anticipated for the Security Hospital of $35 million, and two additional phases anticipated for the Sex Offender Program, which would actually be the construction phases as part of this plan. And our estimates there are currently $18 million and $10 million in the 16 round. Also, statewide asset preservation. We have a number of facilities around the state. We're requesting $2.5 million per bonding cycle, $2.5 million this year, and anticipating $2.5 million in the next bonding cycle. And then finally, early childhood facilities, a request of $3.1 million, which we're also viewing at this point as an ongoing request for early childhood facilities. On slide three, as I suggested, much of the focus of this proposal is on the St. Peter campus. The St. Peter campus has two programs that are located there now, the Security Hospital and the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. We're really strategically trying to do three things with this proposal. First, we want to address critical patient and staff safety issues that arise out of the design at the Security Hospital in St. Peter. We believe that by investing in the facility, we can help to resolve some of the issues that we're having with safety and security for patients and staff. We're not claiming that is all of the issues that are needed in order to address all the solutions that are needed to address those issues. We do believe the physical plant is part of the problem we're having with the St. Peter campus, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. We are also proposing on the St. Peter campus to move in a direction that would separate the vulnerable adult population, which is civilly committed to us, from the sex offender population, which is committed to us. Right now, those populations are both in the St. Peter campus. They both on the lower campus are intermingling and actually have campus privileges. We don't believe this is a good long-term direction. We have one population, which is vulnerable adults, another population, which are classified as predators, and we would like to have those populations physically separated from one another. And then finally, to address the growing pressure on beds in the sex offender program, we're proposing to add beds in St. Peter through renovation, which is a relatively less expensive way to add those beds. And in St. Peter, because that's where we need to have the beds for the sex offender program, not in Moose Lake, which I know folks have dealt with in the past in terms of the sex offender program. St. Peter is where the end stages of treatment are for the sex offender program. That's where we need more capacity right now. That's why we're focusing the sex offender request on St. Peter and not on Moose Lake. Slide four. We have two populations, as I mentioned, that are in the St. Peter campus, both of which are civilly committed populations. That means courts are committing those populations to us. This is currently where most of the services are for the Minnesota Security Hospital, which is serving that mentally ill and dangerous population. On the lower part of the campus, you'll see we have multiple colors. The red are buildings that are used by the security hospital for that same population. The blue are buildings that are currently being used by the sex offender program to house sex offenders who are in the latter stages of that treatment program. And the green are shared facilities, some of which are shared in the sense that there's actually some programming that's shared, most of which are more administrative kinds of services in nature. What we have right now, as I suggested, is on the lower campus, and you can see with the multiple colors, we have people who are committed to us to the security hospital who are classified by law as vulnerable adults and are mentally ill individuals on the same part of the campus, in the same physical space as the sex offender program. And populations from both programs, individuals from both programs, do have campus privileges and are able to move around the campus. And part of what we'd like to address with this long-term proposal is to physically separate those populations, essentially by moving all the security hospital program up to the top of the hill on the top part of the slide here and freeing up the lower part in those buildings, particularly in red, and particularly the Bartlett building, which is sort of to the left there, to be remodeled to create beds for the sex offender program. We might have slides here in a second. Ms. Chair, I'll move to the next slide. Hopefully we can get it up here.
Ms. Johnson, may I just ask,
sure.
Is the then proposed $40 million for the security hospital, would that be located on, I'll call it the upper campus?
Mr. Chair, that's correct, and I'll show you a slide in a second that kind of gets at that. Part of it is renovation of the existing building that you see there, that large sort of odd-shaped building. Part of it is also for construction of some new facilities up on the hill to provide some transition space and some programming space for that population.
Six.
Mr. Chair, the next slide that is up on the screen now shows you, and for those of you that visited the facility, thanks, Tom, what a living space looks like within the security hospital now. And you can see by the graphics that we've overlaid on the slide, we have narrow stairways, poor sight lines. We have the split level design where at the end of these units you have this design where you have stairways going up and down, and you have some people living in the upper area and some in the lower area, all with very narrow hallways. And not good sight lines from where the security staff sit to these areas, mm-hmm. and certainly around these corners. This creates a lot of issues both for patients and for staff in terms of safety. For staff, they're unable to see what's going on around corners, which is, of course, a similar issue for patients. And some of the patients, most of them are on medication. Many of them have issues with going up and down stairs that are created by that medication. In addition, they will often tend to be somewhat fearful of what's going on in their surroundings, and their inability to see around the corner to know who's there and what's going on also affects their ability to feel comfortable and potentially their recovery. We believe that this is not a design that is up to what the current standards should be for a secure hospital or that really promote good treatment for the people that we're working with in the security hospital. The next slide shows you what the current standard of what a secure hospital should look like. This is actually our Anoka facility. Wide hallways, good sight lines, well lit. Good sight lines from the nurse's station so that they can see what's going on around them and so the patients can see as well. So what we're proposing as part of this, your earlier question, Mr. Chair, is to renovate those living areas that are at the end now of that security hospital building to essentially have a single floor that would have, as you see, something like in this picture, wider hallways, better lit, better sight lines for the staff. We believe that'll help both with the treatment and with the safety and security. Right now, difference I didn't mention earlier between the sex offender population and the population that's civilly committed to us as mentally ill and dangerous. The sex offender population, as folks are generally aware, we just had our first conditional release. It's not been a program that there's been a lot of turnover in. That's a direct contrast to the security hospital, where we are moving people through that program all the time. The average stay is about 8 years. We think with a better physical plant and better treatment modalities, we can reduce that length of time, that's longer than what we see in other states in similar kinds of facilities. So part of what we're trying to address here is to make this facility better aligned for what we think the modern kind of treatment is that we need in this kind of a facility.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson?
Would you like questions now or at the end of the presentation?
Well, if it fits the moment, why don't you ask?
Okay. Thank you. I'm wondering about, actually a couple of the things that you just mentioned. You mentioned those shared spaces, and I'm curious how much of that is, roughly percentage-wise, is the different populations sharing those spaces as compared to the administrative services functions?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, actually the next slide kind of shows that a little bit better, and I can talk to it. This is a map. This is a closer-up map of the lower campus. The slides that I just showed you of the living spaces, that's on the upper campus, which is only the security hospital population. So that particular living unit you were looking at, there's no intermingling of the populations there. That's just for the security hospital for the mentally ill population that we're working with. It's on the lower campus where we have the combined spaces. The two buildings that are in red that are circled here, those are buildings that are currently used by the sex offender program. The Bartlett Hall. I'm sorry, by the security hospital program. Thank you, Tom. That are currently used by security hospital program, the Bartlett Hall and Johnson Hall. And the buildings that are in blue are the ones that are used by the sex offender program. Now, you can see two of those buildings have kind of a pinkish line around them. That's a secure perimeter. Those buildings are within a secure perimeter. The Green Acres building is not. The Green Acres building has some sex offenders living in it who are outside of the secure perimeter. Those are folks who are toward the end stage of treatment.
Where is that building? I can't see that.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's the blue building. Can you point to it, Tom? The blue building is kind of on the left there, the airplane-shaped one. And then the Sunrise building has some combined programming in it, a clinic and some other programs, and that's the other airplane-shaped building that's currently in green. What we'd be proposing to do with this proposal is to essentially move those populations that are currently being served in the security program in those red buildings, Bartlett and Johnson, to build space for those end-stage treatment space, transitional space, which is more apartment living. It helps those folks when they're making the transition to the community to get used to living in a more independent kind of situation before we transition them to the community. To build space like that on the upper campus for this population, which would then free up the Bartlett building in particular to be renovated for beds for the sex offender program. You can see the Bartlett building looks an awful lot like the Pexton and Shands, which are the two in that secure perimeter. Very similar building, works very well for the sex offender program. Works very well for the sex offender program. So we think that's really good space. The Johnson building actually is an older building that isn't very useful for any purposes, and under this proposal it would be demolished. The green buildings are mostly shared services. You can see power plant, laundry. Most of those will continue to be shared services under our proposal, continue to provide services to both parts of the campus, and maintenance shop and others. So I think that does that answer your question, Senator Nelson?
Yeah, thank you. And just one follow-up, Mr. Chair. Have there been higher than average, you mentioned a security incidents and safety incidents. Has this been a problem beyond what one would expect?
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, it has been over the last couple of years. Now, 2011, our injuries were somewhat lower than they were in 2010. 2010, we had almost 100 staff injuries, about two-thirds of which were due to assaults by patients. We've had patient injury numbers that are over 300 for that same time period. Again, those are often patient-on-patient assaults. And better security, better monitoring, better sight lines can help to reduce some of that. And I think a better treatment environment where patients are more comfortable in their surroundings and perhaps less aggressive. The injuries, I believe, dropped about 65 in 2011. About half of those were due to assaults of staff injuries. So it has gone down somewhat in the last year, but still very high injury ratios compared to our other programs.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, on slide 9, you'll see specifically what we're asking for in a $40 million request for 2012 for the security hospital. This proposal would include designing and building of a 24-bed secure admissions unit. The admissions unit is very helpful, again, to the sort of flow of treatment through the program. When folks are first admitted into the program, committed to us by the courts, they're often in a state where they're very unstable, where we need to work with them for a period of time to get them onto the right medications, provide other treatment that is needed, so they can start to move into the next stage of treatment where they're better able to live in an environment where they're mixing with other patients. This would also include, as I mentioned earlier, the renovation of the split-level patient units, and also, as I just suggested, building some residential space on the upper campus to replace that space that's currently in the Bartlett Hall to free that space up for the sex offender program. So it's beginning to phase toward getting the security hospital population off of the lower campus and up to the upper campus. And then the second phase, there'd be additional construction of residential and programming space. The next slide shows you the projected census for the security hospital. The census is not really the driver for the security hospital. As I suggested earlier, we're actually hopeful with the redesign that we can reduce the length of time that individuals are in the program, which would actually help to bend this curve down somewhat. But the issue with the security hospital has not really been a bed pressure issue, which is very different than the issue with the sex offender program, as you'll see in a minute, where we've been very driven by the fact that we have commitments coming to us that are increasing the pressure for us to have beds available for that population. This is a map of a design map, a concept map of what the security hospital program on the upper campus would look like after the first phase of renovation. That little building labeled E that you can see is kind of separate there to the upper part of the slide, that's the 24-bed admission hospital that I mentioned before. Again, the exact location of this is not necessarily there, but that's to give you a sense of what it would look like or the concept and about the size and scale of that building. Within the main building there, you see the pink portion that's labeled H, and then you see some red portions toward the end, and then the end points there that are labeled G, which are yellow. Those are those split-level units, basically renovating the end part of that unit and then building onto it to create the kind of one-story space with the wider hallways and so forth that we talked about earlier for sort of the main part of the treatment program. And then the buildings that are kind of scattered here, again, in a concept design to the right, which are labeled F, this would be the latter stage treatment buildings. These are the buildings that would be more apartment-like for those that are toward the end of the treatment and we're getting them ready to transition into the community. The second priority is related to the St. Peter campus as well, and this is the request for the sex offender program. For 2012, we're requesting only pre-design and design funding. Construction, full design will come in later phases. So this would be an issue that would need to be revisited in 2014. This is really, as I suggested before, to plan the remodeling of the Bartlett Hall and to look at the space on the lower campus and develop that space and a plan around that space for expanding the sex offender program. When we're done with this program, we would be able to add, if we follow this all the way through to the request in 2014 and 16, we would add about 200 beds for the sex offender program on the St. Peter campus, which anticipates the next slide, which, as I suggested before, these are the census projections for the sex offender program. As you can see, this continues to go up, 60 individuals a year who are committed to us. And this is based on the current laws, our current experience, the trends that we're seeing of the individuals who are approaching the end of their sentences in the correction system, and the proportion of those that have typically come to us from the court commitment process. We understand and are trying to anticipate that I know Senator Limmer and others are working on ideas as to how to turn this curve on the bed number that we have. We're also interested in those strategies, but we sort of have to be on a dual track. As we're moving forward and looking at other ways we may house the sex offender program, we also have to be looking at how we're prepared for what current law says will be the population we'll be seeing going through 2014.
Ms. Johnson, Senator Stump and Senator Brown.
Mr. Chairman. I was just curious, are these trends similar in other states?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair and Senator, Minnesota has the highest per capita commitment of sex offenders in the nation. So this trend is not similar to what you see in other states. Only about half the states have civilly committed sex offender programs. Other states deal with individuals in different ways. The legislative auditor report from, I believe it was 2010, really dug into this issue and outlined very well how unusual we are in terms of the number of sex offenders that we commit in Minnesota, and had many, from our perspective, good recommendations on how to try to address that going forward.
Thank you.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These are alarming numbers. Is it because we have more sex offenders, or we're just getting better at dealing with them? I mean, that is a huge increase from 2000 to 2018. Can you give some background as to why the huge growth?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair and Senator Brown, I would agree that these are alarming numbers. I don't think there's any evidence we have more sex offenders in Minnesota than other states do. We've chosen to commit more of them, and we've also chosen to use this process of the civilly committed treatment program as the way to address that. And I think that from our perspective, the commitments come to us from the courts. We don't have an option of whether or not we take the individuals in and serve them. And so, as I suggested, we need to be prepared to have the beds online for the population based on our current experience and current law.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Langston, I'll come over.
Mr. Chair, it costs over $100,000 for each one of these. So if you're looking at 1,000 of them, it's over $100 million we're going to be spending. There's a concern that the courts are eventually going to say you've got to let them all out because it's unconstitutional to be able to keep them in civil commitment, which really is just extending their terms is all it's really been.
That may be a comment. I don't know if it's a question. If you want to comment, again, you're on the receiving end. You're a function of what the court tells you to do, and that's to take them and treat them. But Senator Tomasoni,
and that's well taken, Mr. Chairman, because you're responding to what we've given you. But what is it that Is it the civil commitment part of it, of our programs, that is different from other states, or what is different that we have so many in this population and other states don't?
Mr. Chair, I might ask Dan Storkamp to come up and help with some of those questions.
Mr. Chair and Welcome. Members, I'm Dan Storkamp, the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, and members, every state has different laws related to both sentencing and civil commitment. And in some states, civil commitment is only for juveniles. In other states, it's inpatient treatment. In Minnesota, our civil commitment is a secure environment, and they've got to go through treatment, and the courts ultimately decide who comes out. So to get to your question, it really is the different states have different laws surrounding both sentencing and the civil commitment process.
Mr. Chairman, just give me one
second. Senator Tomasoni.
What about Wisconsin? What does Wisconsin do?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni and members, Wisconsin is very similar to Minnesota. The difference, I think, in Wisconsin's case is their process has been underway for quite some time from beginning to end, which means they've got actually a lot of releases each year, 5 to 15 a year. Minnesota's process is just beginning on that tail end of the process with one provisional discharge currently in the works and a couple more currently in the court system. So you're going to see a more mature model in Wisconsin from beginning to end. In Minnesota, we're just beginning that process as we move forward.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, several years ago, it's been now, a collection of legislators went to Wisconsin. Where were we, Mr. Storkamp? I don't remember what town it is anymore. To see their program and to see what it was that they did that we hadn't been able to do yet. And it was really eye-opening to see that they had a fully developed plan for movement through the program and then out into the community in stages. And that's the model that I think we're working toward now. And but it was interesting to see that they really did have a program that was fully developed, as Mr. Storkamp said.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Do they get headlines every time they release somebody like we do here?
Pretty sure.
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, I think any time a sex offender is released in the community, regardless if it's civil commitment or corrections, there's a lot of questions, community notification, a lot of media attention, a lot of stakeholder attention around all of those. So I wouldn't put us in a unique box over everybody else. But given that our first provisional discharge was coming out, I think we got extra special attention this last several months.
Senator Nelson.
I'll pass.
Okay. Anyone else? So continue on.
Mr. Chair, what we're trying to accomplish here, as I said, is to bring on more beds for the sex offender program. Under the current projections, we'd be out of beds in the sex offender program in the summer of 2014. We know there are discussions going on about, as we just discussed here, alternatives for how we might treat this population, serve this population in the community. And so we've taken an approach here different than the idea of just building 400 beds up at Moose Lake, which was kind of the direction we were going a couple of years ago, toward a more phased approach using the St. Peter campus where we want the beds at the end stage of treatment, up to 200 beds, but doing it in stages so that we have an ability to adjust if the census changes at all. But as I suggested a few minutes ago, we need now to make sure that we're on a path to have beds in position for the population that we anticipate will be committed to us. This proposal would take us through the early into 2018 with the additional 200 beds, again, under our current projections, which would get us through the next several years with the sex offender program. Mr. Chair, I think the next slide talks about the 200 beds. I think I already said most of that. And I think that, again, we think the buildings that we have on the St. Peter campus, they're working well for the folks we already have there in the sex offender program. It's the right kind of building that we need. We can get the beds cheaper through renovation than through new construction, so we think it's a more efficient way to move forward in expansion within the sex offender program. Just summarizing the St. Peter campus and what we're trying to accomplish with this proposal, which, as I said at the beginning, is a multi-phase process, improving the safety for patients and staff in the security hospital by bringing that facility to a position where it will be up to the current standards for treatment in a secure environment for mentally ill individuals. enhanced treatment environment for the patients, reducing the average length of stay, the capacity for the MSOP program, as I just talked about, the physical separation of the populations, again, really getting the lower campus devoted to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program and the upper campus for the security hospital, the 24-bed admission unit and the 200 beds, which I've already talked about.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's hard to, with all the stuff going on, it's hard for the chair to catch us when we're trying to get our questions right when it's probably pertinent. But as you're talking about, this is cheaper to renovate than to build new. My question would be, because we've been through this before, where we renovate and then a couple years or maybe even a decade down the road, somebody says, well, the renovation we did, but we had problems with the HVAC, we have problems with the efficiency, the energy efficiency of the building. Have those things been dealt with in this renovation so we know that we're not going to come back later and say, well, yeah, we renovated, but, you know, we should have, would have, could have, you know, dealt with this HVAC, dealt with the building efficiency? Do we have mold problems? Do we have those other kinds of air infiltration issues?
Mr. Johnson. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, the proposal before you is exactly to address those issues. I know we requested $7 million last year to renovate the Shantz building, which is inside the perimeter, and that was for the life safety, the fire, as well as upgrade the HVAC and get that all together. The Bartlett building that we're talking about in the future as well has to go through that same renovation to bring it up to date in codes and life safety issues. So that'll be what we'll be requesting in 2 years. The design will tell us exactly to what level we need to do. But these buildings are built in 1950s, 1960s, and it's time that they do need to be upgraded.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, you know, coming from a construction background, 1950s and 1960s, a lot of times we had other issues with those buildings. So again, before we move ahead and put all this money there, I want to be certain that it's not cheaper to literally bulldoze it over and start anew with what we can do for technology today in building.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator. Looking at all the options available to us, we feel that this is a nice short-term option. So if we needed to build down the road, we still have that option. But short term, I think it's better to remodel because we're not exactly sure the numbers that the sex offender program we're going to have or the security hospital. These buildings are very sound. We have been putting a lot of asset preservation dollars into them to maintain them, and I think they're very viable in this lower campus.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Higgins.
excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just noticed the small print at the, maybe it's because I don't have my glasses on, but in the bar chart where there's a reference to the dual commitments that are held at DOC, so another 55 people there. When you make the proposed changes to MSOP St. Peter, will they be going to transfer to St. Peter, or will they continue to be held at DOC?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, the process that we utilize is completely separate for the treatment versus the dual commits. The dual commits really is the sentencing side of the function. The treatment program.
Explain for people what the dual commits is.
The treatment program actually is designed for all aspects, so therefore they can move through any phase, even though they're a dual commit. They can move from Moose Lake to St. Peter if treatment says they progress to phase two or phase three. So their dual commit doesn't hinder them from moving through treatment. Their dual commit will come into effect if they act out, if there's an incident, or if they're disruptive, and then Department of Corrections can determine if they can revoke them or not based on their what they act and how their incident was.
And, Mr. Chair, just so everybody around the table knows who the – talk a little bit about the process for dual commit. It's corrections and –
Mr. Storkin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, members. In our court system, a person goes before the courts because of the crime that they've committed. The court provides them a conviction, and with that conviction comes a sentence. That sentence is really split in two parts. One part's a prison sentence, and one is on supervised release. And Department of Corrections has the ability, while they're on supervised release, to bring them back in if they've acted out. That's across the board. For sex offenders, when they're getting to their supervised release time, they can be referred for civil commitment and come to our program. They would still have that criminal sentence of supervised release hanging over their head, but they're actually released into our program as a civil commitment. So it is two separate entities that are dual commits in that process.
Thanks for that clarification.
Anyone else? Okay. Continue on.
Mr. Chair, I understand.
We need to kind of wrap it up quickly as we can.
Yeah, time. I'll try to move through quickly.
I didn't want to.
The next slides are
very interesting and important, so I didn't want to slow it down. But
Mr. Chair, the next several slides deal with our third priority, which is asset preservation. Folks are familiar. We have campuses across the state of Minnesota, asset preservation being an important part of maintaining those buildings, life, safety, new windows and roofs, and so forth. We have about $18 million worth of asset preservation on our list right now, and this $2.5 million will get us started in that direction. And you can see some of that on slide 18, a little more detail, as well as slide 19, which details the types of asset preservation, which I imagine folks are pretty familiar with. I'll move then to slide 20. Mr. Chair, this is the fourth priority, which is the early childhood request. This is a request for $3.1 million bonding for early childhood. This is to help communities around Minnesota who are interested in developing facilities for early childhood programming. Usually requires a partnership, often with a school district, sometimes the county or the city, maybe other nonprofits involved, community action agencies and others who are involved in these proposals. This is a little bit different than traditional bonding. There's authority in DHS statutes that essentially this is treated as an RFP, so the money is appropriated to the Department of Human Services. We put out an RFP. Communities send us back proposals, and then we make selections on how we put the funding out to various communities. These grants do require a 50% non-state match from the local community to developing those facilities. We are in the process now of moving forward with $1.9 million in bonding under this provision that we got in 2011. So we are actually in the process now of moving forward on some bonding proposals under that. And you'll see on page 22 there's a map that shows where in the past those – it may not be in the slide presentation that we have here, but you should see in your packet a map of Minnesota with some red pins on it that shows where those early childhood bonding proposals have been over the past 20 years or so. The last two maps you have in your packet show you kind of the end stage of the St. Peter campus. We just put those at the end for your information. See the upper campus entirely dominated by the security program with the outbuildings and the remodeling of the main building. And then on the last slide, the lower campus with buildings devoted to the sex offender program as well as shared service buildings for the whole campus.
Okay. Anything else for Mr. Johnson?
That could be.
If not, thank you very much. We appreciate your review this morning, and of course, we'll hold over these proposals for possible inclusion. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next up is Chris Seide, Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management for the state of Minnesota. Welcome, Chris, to the extent you can help us along and regain some time for us. We'd appreciate it. But, you know, on the other hand, give us your full story.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I've gotten pretty good at talking fast about about this project. And we will be working here to try to get the slideshow up. But you do have our slides in your packet, so I will start with that in order to save some time. The State Emergency Operations Center is the one and only project for the Department of Public Safety this year. The project scope is that we are requesting $26 million for the construction phase of the State Emergency Operations Center and the office locations for the Homeland Security Emergency Management staff and possible co-location of the Minnesota Duty Officer Program and the Minnesota Joint Analysis Center, which are currently in other facilities. The State Emergency Operations Center typically is activated for severe weather. However, in our current threat environment, we have to ensure that we are able to activate an Emergency Operations Center to coordinate state activities with local units of government and meet the requirements of the Department of Homeland Security for all spectrum of emergencies, including health incidents, acts of terrorism, technological incidents, and for special events. We have we typically activate about 45 days a year. We have been averaging over the last few years, 92 days in 2009 and 10, 45 days in 2011, and so far in 2012 we have been fully activated one day for an alert condition at the Prairie Island Nuclear Power Plant, and we are operational yesterday and today for the statewide severe weather that we are having at this time. The state agency staff also activate in this area. As we have our Homeland Security Emergency Management permanent offices, we do have 75 full-time employees, and we have found across the country that it is more efficient to have your staff in your emergency operations center so that you can activate immediately if you need to. We are currently paying for leased space. We are not in a state-owned facility, and we pay about a little less than $1 million every biennium for rent in our current space. For the role of an emergency operations center, as I said, we coordinate the state agency response. We coordinate with local emergency operations centers, incident commanders at the scene, and we are the liaison to the federal government, who also will send staff to an emergency operations center for large events. We provide support to the scene, whether it's technical advice or whether it's logistical equipment. And we also coordinate the public information, which we have found to be the absolute most important part of what we do, is to make sure that state responders and local responders are speaking with one voice. And it's a lot easier to do that in one location where the media can attend. An emergency operations center is truly a critical function of state government. The characteristics of an emergency operations center are five: survivability, security, sustainability, interoperability, and flexibility. These are the core capabilities that the Department of Homeland Security put forth after September 11, 2001. Our current facility currently fails all of these standards. We have undergone assessments from experts at the Minnesota National Guard and also from independent assessment organization through an accreditation visit.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Eady, who's your landlord now? Or do you have several?
Mr. Eady?
Mr. Chair, Senator Magnus, we have Town Square Realty is our landlord.
And Mr. Chairman?
Senator Magnus?
For the new proposal, under your new proposal, would you be purchasing the building, or would you be, for example, the Port Authority be buying it and you renting it, leasing it over a long period of time, maybe you're getting to that. I may be getting ahead of you. Sorry.
That's okay.
This idea.
Mr. Chair, Senator Magnus, sure. We would be purchasing the building through the Department of Administration, and we would be maintaining and operating it for just about the same cost as we now pay in our rent.
Yeah, that's what I'm after. Thank you.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was actually my question from the site. Does the current cost or rent cover what the bonding request would be for the new building? So,
almost exactly.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. This is not simply a Minnesota issue that our facility fails a lot of the Department of Homeland Security standards. It is common across the country, and many, many states are in the process of building or requesting funding from their state legislatures also to build. Our current location is in the town square in downtown St. Paul, and because of that, it does not meet these requirements. The next few slides are showing you some of our shortfalls. The first is survivability. We're in a very high-risk area, a downtown area, directly adjacent to the Capitol complex. We are in a high-traffic area. We are adjacent to high-rises, and now right outside our window will be the light rail transit.
From a security standpoint, we are above ground. We have inadequate security because we do have external exits and entrances from many areas. As you can see in your photos, these are actually taken of our facility from our external. We abut a hotel. We are directly over a parking ramp, and we are vulnerable.
May I just ask? You must, may not, I don't know, but I'm just going to suggest if this went down, wouldn't you back up to some county EOC that could go statewide for you? Or
Mr. Chair,
have a backup plan.
We do have a requirement of one primary and one alternate state emergency operations center. So we do have a local emergency operations center that is our alternate. So if something did happen in downtown St. Paul, that is where we would go. From a sustainability perspective, again, we are in leased space, and our landlord controls our HVAC. There is no air filtration possible in there because we do share the HVAC with many other offices. We have one telecom entry, and we do have weekday-only food service available. From an interoperability standpoint, we're in pretty much of a communication dead zone because of the high-rise buildings. However, we have done some workarounds. We relay to the DOT building, and we get out there. We have to actually lease roof space for our antennas, so that is also not necessarily under our control for our interoperability purposes. The state EOC should be mission ready at all times. We do have a flexible space, but it is simply not enough to make sure that we can have an emergency operations center and continue to provide services in other areas, because when you have an emergency, if it's not a statewide emergency, other things do happen. And so we have to make sure that we are capable of doing that. The next photo you have is right outside our door in the 2008 Republican National Convention. So this is our location, and these are the crowds where we were hearing the flashbangs, we were smelling the tear gas, and we're in a vulnerable position. Your next slide that you have in front of you is the Tuscaloosa, Alabama Emergency Operations Center, which was built 6 months prior to their tornado last May. They made a decision to not harden to some of the level of requirements, and this is what happened when an EF4 tornado made a hit on their public safety building, their emergency operations center, which, of course, impacted their first responders and the support to incident commanders. So where are we right now? Our current...
Senator Pappas, I'm sorry.
This sounds like a good transition point for a question, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Ide, who picked Town Square for the emergency? I mean, I live next door, and I had no idea it was even there. You know, how in the world was that location ever picked in the first place?
Ms. Ide?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, that was picked by... it was picked through an RFP... back in 1997 and basically settled on by the then Commissioner of Public Safety. He wanted all public safety offices together, and we are a division of public safety, so we are all down there. We were in the basement of the Capitol, and after the original World Trade Center bombing, it was determined that all emergency management offices should get out of their Capitol building because most were in their Capitol building, mm-hmm. and because, unfortunately, this is a target, we were asked to get out of Capitol buildings.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Tomasoni.
Apparently it's pretty well hidden, Senator Pappas.
Yeah. Have big signs out.
Mr. Chairman, I just thought that was where you could get your driver's license. I didn't know there anything else. Yeah. Yeah.
Senator Higgins.
Ms. Ide, I seem to remember that, you know, the National Homeland Security kind of gives you some vulnerability points of, you know, kind of things that your EOC should not be. And, you know, this one seems to have them all. It shouldn't be near a public parking ramp. It shouldn't be in a very populated area and those kinds of things. And it's almost like you can go down the checklist, and we don't match up well with any of them, if I remember the list from previous committees. Am
Senator
I right?
Senator Higgins, you are
Eddie.
Correct.
There's concurrence. Okay.
So our current status is that in 2010, the governor did include us in his recommendation for bonding. We received $2.25 million for pre-design and design. We were also required to do a traffic study to ensure that the new location that was available to us was adequate to get state agency responders there, and we did conduct and complete that. The pre-design is completed. We did receive the required recommendations from the House Ways and Means Committee and the Senate Finance Committee for our pre-design, and we have selected a construction manager. The pre-design showed, and we included state agencies, we included local agencies, we included nonprofit organizations, and the private sector in our pre-design for what we needed. And the pre-design showed that we needed a 52,200 square foot building. Actually, it showed that we needed larger than that, but we did hone some of the things back that I'll talk about in a second. That we need approximately 15 to 20 acres for a building of that size with parking for 180 cars. We need to have controlled access, which is part of the requirements of Homeland Security. We needed hardened mission-critical areas. We need robust IT and audiovisual capability, redundant power, redundant communication. We took the needs, which ended up being about a 65,000-square-foot building, and then we looked at the facilities on the National Guard complex that's adjacent to where we would be building. And we want to leverage the use of those buildings so we didn't duplicate it in this building. So we're able to cut out 13,000 square feet by utilizing those guard facilities for our heated storage, for our vehicle storage, for a commercial kitchen, for a fitness type center, so that when we are when we're activated on a protracted period of time, we can still take care of our own staff. And also shower facilities in the area. So we are here today requesting $26 million. A typical office building of this type is $8,500,000. When we add the requirements of Homeland Security for sustainability and survivability, sustainability adds another $700,000. Hardening and redundancy adds another $10,300,000. The technology is another $3.5 million, and then miscellaneous construction-related costs is about $3 million. So when you take $163 for a square, typical office building square feet, we end up being around 313 square feet because of the mission-critical type facility that this is. Your last, the second to the last slide is basically the state, the space plan shows you the adjacencies and the basic square footage of each of the areas of the Emergency Operations Center proper, and then how our offices abut that along with some training facilities, which duplicates as our Joint Information Center. And, of course, then all of our parking. Impacts of not funding a new emergency operations center is that we will continue to have the risks posed by the location of our existing facility, and we will not meet those federal requirements, and which will limit our ability to respond to many other events.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas?
I had two questions, and maybe I missed this, is could you explain to me what hardening is? Did you talk about that already?
Ms. Ide?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, hardening is different. It's different things. It's hardening is making sure that you do have two ways of bringing in air intake. It's also the way that they construct any windows that may be part of it. It's the construction of the walls so that it has the anti-terrorism force protection part of it, the way that they construct the walls themselves. So it's the mission critical areas have to be able to withstand an impact of an EF3 tornado. We have to be 135 feet back, but if it takes a direct blast, then we have to have certain things in our building.
And then Mr. Chairman.
Senator
Metzen.
Metzen, I'm sorry. Then we'll go over here.
Yeah. Senator Metzen. Ms. Heidi, is that about normal $2.25 for pre-design and $3 million for miscellaneous? That's about 20% of the project. It seems like a big numbers, to get $3 million, which is over 10% of the request for miscellaneous. I don't know. Maybe that's typical. I don't know if you know that or somebody from administration should tell us. But like pre-design 2.2, which is already down the road, I guess we spent that. But I used to do a little of this kind of work, not this major stuff in my prior lifetime. But anyway, is that about normal? And like it is 20% miscellaneous and pre-design, so.
Heidi, thoughts?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzen, it is pretty typical because the pre-design and design, so it's all the way through the construction documents is the $2.25 million. That's a set percentage of a project, and then the miscellaneous includes things like the inflation factor. It includes the contingency. It includes site prep and those types of things. So this is pretty typical of a building project, from what I understand.
Okay, thank you, Senator Magnuson. We'll go to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I was, I caught that you would like to locate next to the National Guard a National Guard facility and partner wherever possible with that. Is that land available, and do you have land acquisition in here? How's that all? How is that progressing here with that?
Ms. Heidi?
Mr. Chair, Senator Magnus, I'd like to ask Deputy Director Joe Kelly to talk about that.
Mr. Chair, Senator,
yes, I'm sorry.
Magnus, I'm Joe Kelly. I'm the Deputy Director for Homeland Security and Emergency Management for Minnesota. The land is available. It's at the Arden Hills Army Training Site. We've been working with the National Guard since, as you know, Senator, since before I retired from the Department of Military Affairs. The land is available. We've identified a number of parcels, and we're working it through with the National Guard exactly which one works best for all parties involved. The enabling legislation was passed last session that would allow the state to receive the property from the federal government.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Magnus.
So General Kelly, so the land acquisition is in here. As for the information we would have, and the $26 million and everything, so there wouldn't be another $5 million. Say to, I guess that's getting to my point. Do we that land acquisition's in there then from the federals?
Mr. Chairman, Kelly? Senator Magnus, yeah, there is with this particular arrangement, the land cost is included because it is essentially free land. It's land that is transferred, excess property transferred from the federal government to the state of Minnesota for this purpose. So there will not be a land acquisition cost associated with this project.
Okay, thank you.
And I think Senator Wieger was, did you have one?
Actually, Mr. Chair, I was going to comment on the Arden Hills site and the co-location with other agencies. I think it's excellent, and there's other proposals with Arden Hills as well, and keep visioning that.
I won't say it. Senator Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. General Kelly, I'm just curious, is that area part of that brownfield area? Is there other cleanup that has to be done in that area? I don't know if that was all part of that, if you could speak to that.
Mr. Kelly?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, it is part of the Arden Hills Army Training Site, which is the former Twin Cities Army Ammunition Plant. So the short answer is yes, it is part of that part of that brownfield property. Part of the pre-design and ultimately design process is to determine exactly on the specific parcel of land what contamination is there and if any additional cleanup needs to be done. We believe that is the that liability is the responsibility of the federal government. it is responsibility of the federal government to clean it to restricted industrial standards. So, again, we do not foresee any hidden costs within the project or unexpected things that would pop up regarding cleanup.
Thank you. Okay. Anyone else?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Jensen. It looks like you're meeting a lot of FEMA requirements and Homeland Security. Does the federal government have any money available to help out with this project?
Ms. Idy?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Jensen, until 2012, there was an Emergency Operations Center grant program that was cut out by the Department of Homeland Security. So there is no specific EOC grant program anymore.
Okay. Anyone else on this? No, thank you so much for the information. Hold it over for certainly possible inclusion, and appreciate your presentation. And so next we'll move on to the Department of Corrections and
vision the possibilities of this campus.
Welcome to the committee. Would you introduce yourself and carry on?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and member. My name is Terry Carlson. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of the Facilities Division with the Minnesota Department of Corrections.
My name is Bill Montgomery. I'm the Capital Resource Administrator for the Department of Corrections.
Welcome.
Thank you. The Department of Corrections has four priorities in the governor's capital budget recommendation. We understand that we're on a tight timeline this morning, so we'll try to do our presentation very briefly. The total request for this agency is $53,699,000. The Department of Corrections operates 10 facilities, 8 for adults and 2 for juveniles. Our adult prison population is about 9,400, and our juvenile population is about 130. Our first request is for $15 million for asset preservation. We use asset preservation money to protect the investments that have been made in our state facilities by making needed repairs to infrastructure and building envelopes. We address code and regulation compliance issues with our asset preservation money, including OSHA, Department of Health, Fire Marshal's orders. Asset preservation money also goes to building enhancement projects that improve the safety and security for all, for our staff, for the public, and for the offenders. And additionally, we use asset preservation money to replace old systems that are not energy efficient. We have an identified need of $86 million in asset preservation projects within our facilities right now. So this $15 million will be used for our most critical projects that meet the goals listed on these slides. We have facilities on 11 sites throughout the state, and many of these buildings are very old and in need of ongoing repairs. Red Wing and St. Cloud were built in 1889, and Stillwater was built in 1914. The Faribault and the Moose Lake facilities are converted regional treatment centers that we acquired in the late 80s. These two facilities have been under continual renovation to make the building safer for our prison setting. We use asset preservation money on projects at all facilities throughout the state. And you can see here the types of projects we do. Here are just a couple of photos that show some of our very visible asset preservation needs. At the Moose Lake facility, the exterior wall of a building is in need of a lot of repair, and also the wall at the St. Cloud facility is deteriorating. Facilities submit their asset preservation needs to us at central office, and we use a scoring matrix to prioritize these projects. We look at life, safety, and security needs first, and they get higher points, and then when projects also have energy savings or cost avoidance, they also get additional points. So we distribute this money, like I said earlier, throughout the state, creating jobs in each area of the state. I'm now going to switch to our second project, which is our Shakopee Perimeter Security Fence, and introduce Tracy Belts. Come on up. And she's going to talk about this project.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Please
state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Tracy Belts, warden at Shakopee Correctional Facility. We are requesting $5.4 million to construct a secure perimeter around Shakopee Correctional Facility. Many of you toured not too long ago, so you know we're the only adult female facility in the state of Minnesota. We house all custody level of offenders, so it doesn't matter if they're in there for a nonviolent crime or murder without the possibility of parole. We house them at our facility. In order to meet our goals identified on the slide, we need to have a fence. Below is a concept of what we're thinking about with regards to a fence. You can see it's more decorative in nature. The columns are brick. Hopefully they would match our building. A wrought iron, again, more decorative in nature because we feel it's important to fit in with the community. Some of you know that some community members haven't been supportive of the fence, so we've had several meetings in the past couple of months to talk about the facility and educate people in who we house there and what this project is about and why we need this project. This design demonstrates our understanding of what the concerns have been from some of the community members.
Excuse me, Warden Belt. We have a question from Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Warden Belt.
First, we have no idea what a warden should look like, so it's kind of interesting. that always catches me off guard. You know, you have this preconceived notions of what a warden should look like. Toward the facility.
You're not, Senator Jung, but they don't take male senators there.
Well, good. Good. Well, I'm good because my question will kind of deal with that. When we built this facility, was it designed for something else? Because, I mean, that's the first thing when we toured it, we're thinking, why doesn't it have a fence to begin with? Why wasn't it planned out? And you know, so there was a lot of questions. They've all been circling around the back rooms to date as to why it never had it to begin with.
Yeah. Ms. Belts?
Mr. Chair, Senator, this has always been, since 1919, we have been on this property. I'll show you a slide in just a second where the old building used to be located. We're just right across the street. This has always been the only female facility in the state of Minnesota, so we've always housed these level of offenders there. But with the growth in population, as you can see, we have more violent offenders that we are housing and need to do something to maintain our control over the facility. We need to have that fence to make sure that those offenders stay where they need to stay. Yeah. And I'll talk just a little bit about that now. As you can see, in 1986, we built on the property that we are on now. Back in 86, we had 85 offenders with a total bed capacity of 132. In 2011, we had 594 offenders. We are hovering right now today around 560. You can see some of the changes in just the risk factors below. We had 19 in for murder in 86. We are sitting at 79 in 2011. And again, sex offenders, we had 9 back in 86, and we had 20 in 2011. Since 1995, we have had 7 women escape from our facilities. We had another 15 that had planned to escape, but because of the diligence of our staff, their plans were thwarted, so they weren't able to leave. Those that are of serious concern, we house either in our segregation units or we house them out of state. Currently, we have 6 women that are on interstate compact because they have either escaped or threatened to escape, and we have no way of containing them because we don't have a secure perimeter. As recently as January, we had 3 offenders that were in segregation for threatening to escape. We can't send them out of state. They didn't have enough time to do is just send them out of state. That also causes problems for us because we can't. Segregation is meant to house those that are violating our rules, not for permanent housing like we would need in the event somebody wants to escape and they don't have enough time to be sent out of state. So you can see it takes a lot of resources to manage a facility that doesn't have a fence. this picture talks or just shows you where our property is located now. You had asked earlier, Senator, the old building in 1919 was located just above where you read MCF Shakopee on that piece of the property. In 86, we moved where we're currently located now. The houses that are there were built kind of around us, essentially. We were always located up in that upper corner. In 83, before we constructed what you see now, there was some discussion about putting a fence around the facility. That didn't happen. We're not totally clear on why that didn't happen. It could have been cost savings measure to do that. It's interesting to note, though, in the 70s, there was City Council passed a resolution to build a fence around the facility because there were women there that were very high profile that had escaped, and they were concerned about the safety of the community. So as recent as 1970s, we've had a request from the City Council to build a fence.
So Ms. Belts, so I'm clear in my mind, in that area, MCF Shakopee, are there houses in there?
Around the perimeter of the correctional facility, there are houses.
Okay.
So to the left, to the right, down below you can see the elementary school. We do have the church that has a daycare there, softball field. So, yeah, they're all over.
And you've got an elementary school right there next to you?
Yep. In fact, what I'll do is I'll show you the next slide. That gives you a great picture of the elementary school right across the street. And as you can see, our current structure that keeps the fenders in is a hedge. So,
pretty secure.
The other thing that I wanted to mention is we talked a lot about keeping the offenders in. For us, it's just as important to keep people out. In the past 5 years, we've had 18 documented intrusions on grounds. And those can be anything from kids being on their bikes, not knowing where they're at, to adults cutting across the property there. They don't know they're on grounds. What is more alarming for me are those people that, when they're confronted by our staff, they flee. So you know that they know what they're doing there. You know that they know that they're on a prison. We just don't know what their intent is.
Ms. Belts, I've got a question from Senator Peterson.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was curious, relating specifically to the city, have you ever asked them? It appears a lot of the neighborhoods have been built up around there, and so I was curious about the school. Is that there previously to your new facility, or was that there?
I'm not sure, Mr. Chair and Mr. Senator. I think that it was there, but do you
Mr.
remember?
Chair and Senator, yes, the school was there before the new facility was built.
So, Mr.
Senator
Chair, I guess
Peterson.
In 86.
Yeah, the question is, has the city, have you ever asked the city to pay for a portion of the fence at all based on them continuing to build up around it? Because clearly those homeowners knew it was there when they bought those homes. And,
Ms. Carlson?
Chair and Senator, no, we have not asked the city to contribute to the cost of the project. It's a state facility, and we need the fence, too, for our security of our facility, so we believe it's our cost.
Okay, please continue.
Yeah, with the intrusions on grounds, as I said, there are concerns that I have for staff safety. Anytime there's somebody on grounds that isn't supposed to be there, our staff need to confront them. And with the volatile history that the women have had, there have been threats against them from ex-husbands, ex-boyfriends. Our staff safety is of vital importance to me, as well as public safety. So we really need a fence in order to meet those goals. Not having a fence has been a significant concern for this agency. We've requested a fence many times in the past. A good fence has four components to it. It's deterrence, detection, delay, and deny. And we need a fence that has not only the physical structure, but the internal system that would alarm if somebody's there. That unobtrusive delay detection system is key for a good solid fence. So we're respectfully asking that you fund this project.
Okay.
We're going to move on to our...
Senator Higgins has a question.
Oh,
just a moment.
Yep.
Senator Jungbauer's question made me think. Can you tell us how many of our wardens are women and how many are men?
About half and half. Very good.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
I'm going to move on to our third project, which is at the St. Cloud facility, and I have Warden Miles here to talk about that project.
Good morning, Warden Miles. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Warden, name is Eddie Miles, Warden at St. Cloud Correctional Facility. St. Cloud is the intake facility for Department of Corrections. We receive approximately 350 to 400 offenders a month that are committed to the Department of Corrections. What we're asking for is a $29.9 million request to remodel our existing space for our intake unit, construct a new health services unit, and a loading dock that will be on the outside of our secure perimeter. Our goals is to improve safety for our staff and offenders through improved layouts and safety features. We want to reduce crowded areas of intake and health services. For those of you who toured out there, I think you understand what we're talking about. This project, I believe, speaks for itself. Health services. As you can see in this particular picture here, we have an officer that is in a particular area that does not have a security around this officer. We serve approximately 1,000 offenders in health services when the health services were built for 600 offenders. The new construction would allow us to be able to put this officer in a bubble in a secured area with some better sight lines. And in some of the areas that health services currently now, you can't see at all. So it is a nightmare event of we have an emergency. And it's a concern that keeps me up at night. We need some comprehensive medical exam space needed to perform screenings for all the offenders that come through there. Intake. We want to renovate an existing space for a new intake. We process approximately 700 offenders in and out of intake every month. Again, for those of you who toured the facility, it is extremely small. Location size is inadequate. It's poor for the type of offenders that come through there. On any given day, we can have anywhere from 30 to 60 to 70 offenders in the intake area all coming in and out of the same door. Again, it's an area that is too small, and we would like to renovate this particular area. This particular picture here on this given day, we had 68 offenders in the intake area. In a cell that probably should have about 3 to 5 offenders in it. This day it had 30 offenders in one cell, and we had another 38 in a different cell that was processing out of the facility that day. Again, it's a nightmare. It scares me to the point to where the fear of making sure that we have the right offenders coming in and the right offenders going out. So we're really trying to protect the public we need more space, more cells, more individual cells. We get many requests that we can't keep offenders separated, incompatibility issues when offenders are fighting. In the event there's an emergency, it'd be extremely difficult to go in and contain that area. Loading dock. We have approximately 1,000 vehicles that come through on a quarterly basis through our loading dock. This particular picture here will show you that currently, all of our trucks enter through the secure perimeter. Our truck gate is too small to a point to where long bed trucks, as you see, we would have to open up both doors in order to get one in. And every time you open up a door of your security, it reduces your security. So we would like to be able to construct a new loading dock area outside of secure perimeters, give us an opportunity to search those trucks more thoroughly, as well as search the equipment that's coming in with metal detectors on the outside secure perimeter.
All right.
Okay, any questions?
Yeah.
Okay. Senator Metzen.
Okay. Eddie Miles?
Yes, sir.
When did you play football for the U?
Huh? 1986 through 89.
Oh, I remember the name.
Thank you.
I suppose you, you're a legend in your own mind.
Yes.
I remember
and
that.
And many of ours.
Did you, Warden Miles, did you ever beat Iowa? That's what we want to know.
Actually, yes. We beat Iowa, Mrs. Senator. We beat Iowa my senior year, 43-7.
Okay. You know I like this word. You know, I have two favorite football teams, Minnesota and whoever's playing Iowa.
I grew up a Hawkeye fan, Mr. Chair.
Pardon me?
I'm from Iowa. I grew up a Hawkeye
well,
fan.
I can't.
That's right. You want to live that here?
I'm close to Iowa, so I can't.
Iowa.
Okay, we have
Mr.
another.
Mr. Chair, when I student taught in Fairmont, Iowans were called Iowegians.
I know. Yes.
My students would write stories about Iowegians.
Well, they used to have the blue license plates down in Iowa, and we'd say anyone that flunked the test in Minnesota could get a blue license plate. Members, we can go past, we're going past the 10 o'clock hour by a little bit, and we'll just continue on and finish this testimony. So we have another warden in front of us, I think. Warden Michelle Smith, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
I'm Michelle Smith. I'm the warden at the Stillwater Correctional Facility, and we are here to talk about our water and well treatment facility. In order to avoid services and interruptions, we have over 1,600 offenders at our location. We're requesting $3.39 million for this project. Stillwater operates currently two wells. Our one well was built in 1914 and does not comply with the Department of Health regulations because it's too close to a sanitary sewer line. We currently use this as our backup well. The second well that was installed in 1961 serves as our main source for the facility. The project includes installing a new well that would become the main water source for the facility and then capping and sealing the 1914 well, installing a new system to remove high iron content and efficiently softening the water, replacing piping that is close to failure due to rust and corrosion, and the construction of a new building for the water treatment equipment. In this slide, you can see that our piping is highly corroded, and we've taken additional safety measures with staff who have to inspect and maintain these systems. The project is an urgent and critical need for the facility. For over 10 years, the Department of Health has told us that we need to stop using the 1914 well. This year, the Department of Health made a point to state that we should cap the well and certainly at any time could mandate the recommendation. We need two wells to provide adequate water supply and fire suppression to the facility, and additionally having a backup well in the event of any primary well failure is needed for a facility of this size and complexity. The photos show the corroded pipes and they could fail. The current water treatment equipment has failed at least twice in the last month and actually currently is non-functional. When this equipment fails, the water pressure is lost. It causes large-scale disruption to the facility operations, obviously including the power plant, all of the equipment, our new boilers, laundry, food service, offenders obviously not being able to flush toilets, which causes severe issues in a prison setting. Additionally, the current equipment is not environmentally or economically efficient. We spend about $50,000 a year in salt. We are backwards in our system where we soften the water. The new process would be more efficient and effective and would benefit, likely improving the longevity of our industrial equipment, boilers, and other equipment that we spend asset preservation money to maintain. The current water treatment system is located in a small building, as is the emergency generator for the facility. The chemicals in their full strength are very corrosive and damaging to the building. The building itself is not conducive for the water treatment and the distribution process. The new building would simply secure the warehouse-style building and would have filters, softeners, pumps.
Okay. Thank you. We have a question from Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Warden Smith.
And you know, I had these preconceived notions that all wardens look tough and mean and nasty, and you know, stereotype is broken today. You know, I can't believe it. I guess I would like to get some detail on this. That's what I do for a living is water and wastewater treatment, and as a matter of fact, most of what we deal with is non-chemical treatment because chemical treatment is long-term, can be very corrosive to equipment and things, and biological treatments are much better for people and pipes and things. But this just seems really high for what you're talking about doing, so I'd like a real breakdown of the details of the well and the treatment and the building and those sorts of things, if I could get that.
I don't currently have that. Mr. Chair,
Montgomery?
Senator, Yep. I don't currently have that information with me at this time, but I can supply that information to you and get that to you next week if that would be sufficient.
That'd be great to get that offline. Thank you so
All
much.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That'd be great. Thank you. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Jensen.
For the commissioner and maybe Mr. Montgomery, your asset preservation, you know, you're asking for $150, $160 million in three cycles. Have you thought about building new buildings instead of that much money into these very old buildings now?
Commissioner Carlson or Mr. Montgomery? I think that's an interesting question because, a lot of money out there. And
Mr. Chair and Senator, we often look at the option of building a new building, but typically it's less expensive to renovate an existing facility than it is to build a new building, unless the purpose that we are going to be using that building for is no longer suited for that building. And so we try to be we try to take as good a care of the facilities that we're entrusted with as possible and to give them an extended life as much as possible. Much of our facilities, as you can see from our request on asset preservation, do need a lot of renovation. But oftentimes the cost of putting in a new facility exceeds what it will take to do the asset preservation to bring it up to current standards and make it serviceable for the future. And when we do, in the case of St. Cloud is an example, where we do run into a case where we just can no longer renovate, then we do ask for money for new facilities to be located, in this case, inside the existing facility. I think the last new facility that we put up was the Rush City facility, which was a brand new facility on a brand new piece of land up north in Rush City. But typically, we try to work within our existing constraints to make the best use of the existing facilities that we currently have.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator
just
Pappas,
just a short question: how much was the Rush City facility?
Oh my gosh!
You want to get back to Senator Pappas,
sure.
Commissioner?
Just an idea of the cost of building over renovating.
Okay. Mr. Montgomery or Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the facility at Rush City was $79 million, $89 million.
Today.
And today it would be $127 million.
Mr. Chairman, and that's minimum security?
No, that is a
close custody
maximum security facility.
Okay.
Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
Yeah, I think the questions are really good from Senator Pappas and Jungbauer and staff member Jensen. We've really got to be thorough on whether to rehab or to build. Senator Langseth and I and some others were around when we took on the transportation building. $5 million, $10 million, $15 million. It got up to $65 million, and it's still the same building. It looks the same. I'm sure, you know, it's asbestos and other problems. But I think, and we thought, a couple of us at the table here thought, back then, knock it down, and for about $30, $40 million, you'd get a modern building that'd look a lot better in my mind than that goofy thing we got over here. But that's what the discussion is all about. That thing got up to over $60 million bucks in rehab, and that's what we have to be very cognizant of, you guys and administration, when you're looking at remodeling. So, I mean, you can throw a lot of good money probably after bad, too, you know, as you go forward on some of these things. So, and I'm not an expert. I'm just giving an example of what we did wrong, I think, over here. $65 million bucks in that building.
Yep. Mr. Chair and Senator.
And it's still ugly.
Another example of something that we did recently was down at the Faribault facility, where we added four 416-bed housing units, new units, to replace existing facilities that were then torn down on that particular campus. Yep. So that campus has essentially become, which was originally given to us, it was a Department of Human Services facility that was repurposed for the Department of Corrections and didn't serve us very well. And we came to the committees on a number of occasions. I think we did that in a phasing of a couple of different bonding sessions to get new buildings put up to serve us instead of the old buildings. So we are conscious of that particular difficulty.
Okay, good points, everyone. Let's keep those in mind. Any further questions? If not, we better move out of here. We've got other folks coming in. And
thank you for your time today.
But thank you very much, Commissioner and the Wardens, and thank you for your work for the state.
Right now.
With that, our next meeting is Monday evening, 6 o'clock. With that, the meeting's adjourned.